Maybe your concept of entrepreneurship doesn't have to be those Mark Zuckerbergs and Elon Musk. Maybe it's just a person doing what they can in a small community, and that can have immeasurable impact and change as you go along.
Welcome to Crazy Smart Asia, the unexpected stories of Asia's disruptors. I'm your host, Chong Xiao Wei. Every week, we talk with a young leader about the crazy smart approaches they're taking to achieve success and tackle some of the biggest issues facing Asia today. Farming might not be top of your list if you're an entrepreneur looking to make a ton of money fast. It's hard work, laborious, and the margins are extremely tight. Unless, of course, you're looking to build a different model of success. This week's guest is the multi-talented farmer, chef, entrepreneur, and even chocolatier who's risen to success as the founder of the Cacao Project, a restorative agroforestry initiative based in the Philippines. From getting her first big break on MasterChef Junior at the age of 12 to giving her first TED Talk at the age of 24, Louise Mabulo has many fascinating stories and insights to share on building a scalable social impact business that can help farmers and food supply chains around the world. Here's my conversation with Louise.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Okay. Hi, Louisa. Welcome to Crazy Smart Asia. It's so good to have you here. Thanks so much, Yowei. I'm really glad to be here on Crazy Smart Asia. Hi, everyone.
So we're going to start off with some quick fire questions. The very first question is, can you describe what you do in one sentence?
Okay. So what I do is build sustainable and resilient livelihoods for farmers in the Philippines.
Nice. And what is your mantra in life?
My mantra in life is, stewardship for people, for planet, and for God.
I like that. And what is your one life-changing advice that you've ever received?
I think that would be advice from my mom, which is to do it now, do your very best, find your niche, learn from your mistakes, and do it better.
Cool. And final question, what's your biggest guilty pleasure?
Oh, I think this is obvious. It's going to be chocolate. I eat way too much of it.
I figured it would be. Okay, so let's start from the beginning, Louise. So you grew up in the city of Swansea, right, which is in the south of Wales, before you actually relocated back to the Philippines when you were 10, I believe.
Yeah, around that time.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's an interesting story because I think I like reverse engineered the story of how most Filipinos grow up. People aspire to leave the country. But for me, I was raised in South Wales in the UK. It's a beautiful rural town. Very quiet, lots of hills and sheep. And we moved back to the Philippines. And coming home was a whole process of falling in love with, you know, my whole country and my culture and my home.
Yeah.
I came from a society that was very convenient. You can go to the grocery store and do what you like. But now I'm in the middle of nowhere. Just rice fields as far as I could see, rainforests and mountains, and not a single mall in sight. So that was a whole culture shock for me. And I had to learn to fall in love with my home country. Coming back to the Philippines was my first exposure to poverty. And, you know, as early as 10, 9 years old, I was already trying to understand how this world worked and why it was so inequitable. And I started engaging in charity work. But that was kind of the very beginning. And then at the age of 12, I was on MasterChef Junior.
Yeah.
And I started going in a TV reality show in a whole different route that began my career.
So before we go into the MasterChef experience for you, what was your childhood experience like in the UK? What was growing up in Wales like?
I mean, it was a really interesting time because I was this like brown girl from Southeast Asia who did not adhere to societal standards of like what people expected there. I thought of myself as this white kid that grew up in a school where I was one of the few people of color. And I had a whole mindset of being this person who was in the global north, and I didn't know what it was like to be Filipino truly. I mean, I loved being in South Wales. It taught me a lot of things about loving nature, learning to enjoy exploration, and a lot of fundamental characteristics that I have today. I think it really grew with me. But again, it wasn't really something that I, how do I explain? It wasn't something that I thought I fully fit in, because I knew I was deeply inherently Filipino, and I was growing up in a whole society that didn't adhere to what I look like or what my culture, what my parents taught me. And I'm still grateful for that time, and I still love the UK so much, but it's a whole chapter of my life where I learned so much from fundamentally. And even if I don't realize it today, it shaped many of the ways that I think.
For example?
Well, for example, right now I work in the agricultural industry. And if I grew up in the Philippines, I don't think I would have ever chosen to call myself a farmer or be a farmer. In the UK, if you say you're a farmer, it would be this person who owns tractors and tracts of land. You would have sheep and all sorts of buildings and infrastructure and assets. And that was considered as a desirable thing. But in the Philippines, it was the complete opposite. Filipinos always perceived agriculture or farming as an industry that was bound for failure or poverty. And so there are stigmas and stereotypes that I would have had growing up in the Philippines that I currently don't have because I grew up in South Wales. And I brought that with me here. And I hope to change people's mindsets and stigmas around farming and agriculture and maybe marry it into entrepreneurship, which is how it is predominantly in the global north that we don't have here.
And what actually brought you back to your motherland, the Philippines? In what ways was this move so life-changing for you?
Oh, man. I mean, my parents brought me back home. My dad was, my dad entered politics when I was back here in the Philippines. And I think the fact that he was so exposed in the front lines to the social, societal issues in the Philippines, and he was so deeply nationalistic that he wanted to help his country more than, you know, he was willing to sacrifice a good life overseas to come home and risk everything for his people. That was life-changing to me because it was my first exposure to true poverty, my first exposure to developmental issues and understanding that there's a whole world out there beyond just me surviving and getting by and living a good life. And it taught me the importance of taking care of community. It taught me the importance of understanding the values and nuances of culture, and to really treasure that because it's something that's dying and something that we're losing throughout our generation, especially my generation. We stop valuing it when we think of it as some antiquated idea. But really, it's something that we should bring with us and carry and hold and evolve as we're also developing.
So did you follow your dad on his campaign runs? Is that how you actually experienced and saw what was happening on the ground?
I did in his campaign, but also once he was in office and going out to the mountains. I remember a very early memory. I was around 9 to 10 years old, and we were at the side of a mountain, and we were watching school children come home from school, and their school was kilometers away from home. They were walking barefoot down the mountain, and then they had, instead of school bags, they had plastic grocery bags that were tearing apart at the seams, and they were just, you know, they didn't have these resources. And I grew up in the UK where all of these things were provided to me, my school bag, my uniform. I had free breakfast and lunches in school. Education was free for me. And public school is free here, but it's just not the same quality of education and services that they give to children. And I was so young, but I remember crying and looking at my dad and being like, what government agency is responsible for these children? Why are they like this? Why is it so hard for them?
Yeah.
And then my mom pointed at my dad and said, he's responsible, so we're going to fix it.
Oh, no. And that was when he was first coming into office, right?
That was his first few months in office. So he was saying, this is what we're here to fix.
Yeah.
And we need to help. So at 9, I was like, okay, how do I help? I didn't understand how government systems work. So I went to the city. I went to my school program at the time and raised funds to get them clothes and shoes and school bags. And we managed to raise two truckloads worth of school bags and clothing and items for these kids. So now it's a lot better. But that was my first exposure to this. I didn't think that people lived like that. And it was my first time thinking that I could do something personally. Yeah. And it wasn't something that I'd leave to someone else to fix.
And this was actually happening in your backyard, right? This was in the same community that you grew up with.
Yes, absolutely. The place that I'd moved into, it's in the middle of nowhere. And I mean, I love it. It's beautiful. It's full of nature. But I knew that there was something that I could do to fix it. And it's not fixing it. It's just being able to give a helping hand and build equity for people who have less than me.
I love that. So before we actually go deeper into that story, after you moved back to the Philippines, your dad ran for office, you actually achieved a lot of milestones on your own as well before you actually became a teenager. So I'm talking about before you actually turned 13. So growing up, you actually had a passion for chocolate?
Yes, I did. So at the age of 12, I was on MasterChef Junior. Yeah. It was the very beginning of my career. So I jump-started me. I was on television. I was doing cooking demonstrations. And a lot of chefs had spotted me and figured out that, oh, this kid can cook. And so I was like, yes, I'll take all these opportunities that I could to develop this passion I had for food. And one of them was chocolates. I've always dreamt of being a chocolatier. I've always dreamt of being a chef. I wanted to work in the world's best restaurants and, you know, just marry this passion of food and systems and farming and everything that I learned about my culture and about what I had and just put that on a plate and be able to share that with people that enjoyed it. Mm. So I was on MasterChef, but I also won a plethora of awards as a chef.
Where did that passion for food and chocolates actually come from?
I think it really began. There's a lot of places it began, but it would start in the family kitchen. I mean, in Asian cultures especially, I grew up where the kitchen is the living room. My grandmother would drag us all begrudgingly into the kitchen. We would help chop the vegetables and, you know, stir the stews. My uncle was also a chef and he would kind of teach me practical techniques. But also my grandmother here in Kempster, where I moved to, she had a cocoa tree outside and she would kind of pull apart the pods and make them into hot chocolate. Mm. And I love this hot chocolate until I saw the moment that she processed it. And it turns out she would like suck individually in each of the beans and then dry them out in the sun with her saliva and all.
Oh.
And that was the whole process of making chocolate. And it made me curious, like, how is chocolate made? I didn't realize that you could do this in our backyard. So that kind of began a curiosity and realization that much of our chocolate in the world is produced in places like the Philippines, Indonesia, in South Africa, in Cote d'Ivoire, West Africa, and in kind of Latin America. And all of this is processed in Europe and turned into packaging there. But I wanted to bring that home and see what we could do in processing it here and making our own flagship chocolate.
Mm. What brought you onto Junior MasterChef? Why did you decide to join the competition?
Well, I decided to join the competition. I remember it was a call in the afternoon. People saw my posts on Facebook. I was making all sorts of dishes and sandwiches and meals at home that we would post on a very early iteration of Facebook. And I don't know, it was just something that I loved. And I thought, hey, why not try it? I love food and I really enjoy this, you know, process of making something. And if there's an opportunity to go on MasterChef and share that with the world, then Absolutely, I'll go for it. And I was young, so I thought, why not?
Oh, no. So about 5 to 6 years later, I think it was when you were around 17 or 18, right? After one of the worst typhoons hit Philippines and destroyed so much crop, you actually saw that there was an opportunity in the moment of crisis and that led to the start of Cacao Project. Like, what is the story behind it and why did you name it the Cacao Project?
At this time, I was operating as like the chef hosting pop-up dinners. And one of the things that I'd identified as a chef was that I wanted to look beyond the food on our plates or even me as a chef in a kitchen, but to the food systems and where the food came from. Because I noticed that our consumers and producers were so kind of disconnected from each other. Mm. So through my pop-up dinners, I was highlighting the stories of farmers and the stories of where these ingredients had come from, and especially Filipino food and these aunties and uncles that I'd worked with. So we were hit by this super typhoon in my hometown and 80% of agricultural land was destroyed. So It meant that many of these aunties and uncles and lolas and lolos had lost a lot of their agricultural harvests and would have to regenerate their farms. And this was so personal to me because this would, not only would it affect me as a chef, but it also meant that for months and years, these people would struggle to make a decent income. Mm. And that leads to other issues like social insecurity problems, their own safety, being able to have proper nourishment or day-to-day nutrition. So I realized that there was an opportunity to build something new here, or at least intervene in a way that was meaningful. I had a platform. Mm. And I used it to do a seed exchange program and get them to revive their livelihoods little by little, month by month. And I realized this is a deeply systemic and deeply rooted issue because the typhoons hit the Philippines every single year. And it just gets worse year by year with climate change. And we've seen it. So how do I help these farmers without them just surviving year after year, but helping them be prepared and recover faster and better? And that's how we started the cacao project. So I recalled my grandmother and her cacao in her backyard, and I was walking around and I saw these cacao trees were regenerating faster than other crops. Corn and coconut and rice would experience significant losses in a long recovery time, whereas cacao was kind of person height. So it wasn't cut down by high winds. It wasn't flooded out so easily. It was something that's been in our ecosystem since the 1500s. And not only that, but the world loves chocolate. We consume so much chocolate and the world cocoa markets are impacted by production issues and climate change and deforestation. So I thought, why don't we tap into that? So we started what we call diversifying these ecosystems and forests. We already had coconut plantations and rice farms and cornfields. But what if we could diversify the plots of land that our farmers had and plant cocoa along with other crops that were resilient to storms and things that were economically sound for them?
Yeah.
So we grew cocoa, and that's when we began it and called it the Cacao Project. Because as we were going, I realized, hang on, this is a whole system. I think I need to establish this and formalize our process. And that way we can provide more services to farmers in the long term, because this isn't a one-time band-aid thing. This is a long-term solution that needs to be kind of watched and taken care of.
So you're saying that cacao had already existed in the land that you were looking at. So actually the environment was very favorable for the farmers to actually diversify into a cacao, like cultivated cacao. Is that right?
That's right. So our land had already had cacao for years. In fact, in the 80s, we had a thriving cocoa industry that fell off after the 90s due to, I think it was this gap between the farmers and the tradesmen. And a lot of our farmers do grow cocoa. They just don't know how to cultivate it properly. And they don't know how to make the chocolate in the post-harvest side. So what we do is provide the farmers with the input and training they need to do post-harvest processing and to make chocolates themselves. So that way you make the chocolates on the field where they're grown. And I think that's an incredible process, which surprisingly hasn't been done as predominantly before.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
How would you say that your approach to this business of farming is different from everyone else in terms of how they're operating within the agriculture sector? Like, what kind of change are you trying to effect, basically?
Yeah, definitely. This approach is what I like to call a Frankenstein's monster of a business model, because we're helping farmers plant the seeds in the ground and plan their farms all the way from the very beginning. We get to watch the trees grow, and we get to work with the farmers and get to build and cultivate that community alongside the agroforests that we're building. So what we're trying to do is make sure that farmer livelihoods are also in harmony with nature and the ecosystems they build. And beyond that, it's also making sure that farmers have more economic control over their harvest. So instead of being dependent on tradesmen, they're completely holistically able to do their interventions at any stage of the value chain, whether they want to sell fermented and dried beans, whether they want to make chocolates themselves, whether they want to make cocoa vinegars or cocoa teas, or whatever it is that they want to do. They have financial and kind of trade autonomy, which is quite unique, because obviously that's not exactly the most profitable or the best business model if you think about, you know, profits or economic gain. But it's also recognizing that our nature is our economy, and that through our livelihoods, we're working with nature, and that nature will provide us economic benefits like windbreakers in the event of storms, resilience, and that 10, 20, 30 years down the line, we'd still be harvesting even more abundantly than we do today.
Mm. And how many farmers are you hoping to impact by the end of 2025, let's say? And how many farmers have you already impacted?
So we've impacted directly 200 farmers, going on to 400, actually. Mm. But by the end of 2025, well, it's 2024 and now, hopefully we'd have 600 or more farmers. The thing is, we want these farmers to be able to chart their own path and have ownership over the project. That it's not just mine, it's also theirs, and that they can replicate it. So maybe I won't be able to impact a farmer right now, but these farmers will become leaders in their own villages and communities and teach other farmers to do even better. And so it's replicable, and it's very holistic. It's intersectional, and it's not a very selfish business model, unfortunately. But it's for the betterment of our community.
Mm. But what would you say is one of the biggest challenges that you've faced in order to push through? Or something that still gives you like the cold sweat in your nightmares?
Oh gosh. I mean, there's so many things that I'm terrified of and I'm afraid to give it a name. But I mean, in 2020, we were hit by 3 super typhoons. And with these climate changes and shocks and droughts, it's terrifying because a lot of what we've built can be undone so easily with severe weather changes or just the fact that we're very dependent. Agriculture itself is reliant on the alchemy of sunlight and air and water. And so if anything of that changes, especially with climate change in a 1.5 degree Celsius world, I mean, we're always beholden to those regardless. But beyond that, it's also one of the things that I'm kind of concerned about is making sure that these farmers have the ability to transfer this knowledge across generation. I mean, of course, right now we work with farmers and the average age of farmers is 70 plus years old. But being able to make sure that this work is a legacy job, that it goes down the next generation, that young people will want to aspire to be a farmer or that they will continue the work of their parents. Because building an agroforest isn't an overnight endeavor. It takes years and it takes generations. So hopefully the next generation can learn to value the work built today.
And what do you think it would take for them to see it as a viable career or a viable legacy to continue?
That's something I'm currently working on. It's making sure that agriculture itself is inherently sustainable and profitable and that young people can think of it as cool. When you go to schools, people will teach you, you know, if you're failing in the agriculture, if you're failing in school, you'll end up as a sweet potato farmer or a rice farmer or a water spinach farmer. And so young people think agriculture is synonymous to failure or poverty. But through our work, we want to show them that it's not just farming out in a field. It's also building economic resilience. It's also a green job, technically. It's land stewardship. And it's also something that can intersect with arts and design, entrepreneurship, and community development. And I think that that's something that young people, especially my generation, is very interested in returning to.
So what are you hoping to achieve in the near future for Cacao Project? Any specific projects that you guys are working on?
Yeah, there's so many things actually to look forward to in the coming years. I think one of them is looking at, again, I mentioned this, is putting the scientific know-how of food systems from the Global South perspective, but also doing a little bit of agri-tech and making that accessible for farmers, looking at satellite mapping technology, maximizing land space, but also expanding with our farmers to create a circular economy. I want to make a model of an agropolis where farmers are at the forefront, that development, it can be agricultural based, especially in an economy and GDP that's dependent on agriculture systems, but also making sure that farmers are completely equipped with climate knowledge, that they have the system they need to maximize and reduce waste and also regenerate landscapes and absorb carbon. That farming work is landscape stewardship and that there's more economic benefits to growing food than there is from extracting from the land.
Okay. So you've worn many, many, many hats. You mentioned that you were a chef. You were on TV. You also had a stint as a TV presenter, right? And now, obviously, you're a social entrepreneur. Which role did you enjoy the most?
Oh, I enjoy them all in equal measure. I think they all feed into each other. I would never be a TV presenter if I wasn't a chef and if I didn't understand farming and where our food came from. And I would never be a chef if it weren't for farming and agriculture and, you know, putting farm-to-table food. And I wouldn't be a farmer if I weren't a chef. I feel like being a chocolatier, doing all these different things, just kind of marrying to each other. I love them all in equal measure. And it's so hard for me to separate.
It's like choosing which is your favorite child, right?
Yeah, yeah. They're all my babies and they're all me.
And you also mentioned that you have plans to actually expand the cacao project overseas. Do you want to share a little bit more about that?
I mean, I really want to expand overseas. I think my goal, hopefully, is to be able to work in places like Indonesia and West Africa. Mm. I think the idea is not just to make a business model, but to make a model that's replicable across countries so that the work that we do isn't just something that's applied here. But if someone elsewhere who could lead the project sees that they can do it there, and maybe another young person or a young woman who says, hey, I could do a cacao project here, or it doesn't even have to be cacao. It could be jackfruit or moringa or something else. If it helps develop local economies, livelihoods for farmers, and also does climate work, then that's something that I'm definitely interested in exploring and an avenue that I want to take in the next 5 or so years.
Mm. I love that. So last year during summer, you actually gave a TED Talk, which is an amazing achievement. Congratulations.
Thanks so much.
So what was that experience like? Do you feel ready now to take on more public speaking challenges?
Oh, wow. Yeah. You know, I gave public speaking engagements since I was a teenager, but there was nothing more terrifying than standing behind the red curtain and delivering a TED Talk. And more so when it came to stories of regeneration and the stories of my grandfather and grandmother and the things that they told me and giving justice to that. So it was a trial by fire, I like to say, and it was a great experience. I really enjoyed it. And I hope to be able to deliver more because the work that I do here isn't isolated to the Philippines. I mentioned it could be done in different places. And I hope that through listening, many people can resonate and hopefully apply those different pieces of knowledge wherever they are. Mm. And that applies to policy, that applies to civil societies and systemic individual change as well.
Mm. What were you thinking when you were standing behind the red curtain? Just about to go up on stage.
I remember hearing my heart beating in my ears and just thinking, oh, I hope my mom is going to be proud of me after this. Getting onto that stage isn't an achievement for me. It's an achievement for my farmers, my work, my communities.
Yeah.
And being able to communicate that to a global stage as large as TED was just massive. So I wanted to give justice to the people behind the work. Mm. And hopefully I was able to do it through my TED Talk.
Mm, that's amazing. So what is something that you believed 5 years ago that you know now not to be true?
Wow. Oh my goodness. So much unlearning. I think 5 years ago, I was very much a subscriber to techno solutions and thinking, you know, I would have all the answers to my community. And I think 5 years ago, this is when we began our farmer field schools. And I came there with the intent to teach farmers. And then I learned that there is so much to learn from them. And this is when I realized that farmers had these stories that didn't make scientific sense, but made so much sense when you applied them. And over the span of 3 to 6 months, I just spent all the time I could to hear these stories and learn from them and figure out that it was a two-way street, that we shouldn't kind of take for granted the crazy lessons of our elders, but instead gather all that wisdom up and understand why it exists, where it comes from, and how we might bring it forward. So I feel like the past 5 years are still unlearning. I mean, I've subscribed very much to hustle culture of being out there and using up all my time and maximizing it. But sometimes the best lessons we can is to take it slow, think more holistically and intersectionally, and to just really listen.
I like that. I like listening. I think that's a very good advice. So earlier you gave your best and life-changing advice that you have received personally, right? But what would be an advice that you would give to people who want to build either their own company or their own brand, or who want to explore a career in activism or advocacy?
I mean, it's similar to the advice that I got myself, is really build your own niche. Sometimes, you know, change is going to be in an industry that doesn't currently exist, or you could create that industry. Mm. When I first started in agriculture and food systems and environment, people were saying agriculture is sustainable. That's never going to happen. Agriculture is inherently extractive. And people couldn't fathom the idea of tree planting and environmentalism with, you know, planting crops and food production. and I was called crazy. So maybe now you're in an industry that's inherently unsustainable. Maybe it's your role to make it sustainable. Maybe change doesn't have to be this huge overnight success. And maybe your concept of entrepreneurship doesn't have to be those Mark Zuckerbergs and Elon Musk.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just a person doing what they can in a small community. And that can have immeasurable impact and change as you go along.
Mm. So what personally is a priority for you right now in your life, whether personally or professionally?
I think my priority is always to learn and grow. And for me right now, it's learning. I need to learn more about tech and bringing agricultural tech to the rural communities. But also personally, I think it's also learning to manage my time better and understand the different ways that stewardship can form, and that sustainability for my industry and my environment isn't just about that, but it's also me taking care of myself as a form of healing. Because when I am at my best and perform my best, then I can give my best to others.
Mm. So just now you mentioned also taking it slower, right? You used to believe in the hustle culture, but now you're believing in a slower pace life. But how do you balance as an entrepreneur? How do you balance trying to have a social life, seeing friends, being young while building an incredible business that's impactful?
I mean, that's still something I'm learning. I'm a student right now. I'm still studying international relations and security studies. I'm, of course, entrepreneur. I'm still doing my culinary work. I'm still doing a little bit of everything just because I love it so much. But I realized that, you know, being an entrepreneur and these spaces in the climate movement have brought me to my closest friends. And I find them at conferences. I find them when I travel. And that has built meaningful connections. I mean, it used to be about the scale of building more and larger networks. And now it's really the quality of people that I let into my life and having to spend time with them. And then there's also that fact that I love farming and agriculture, and I have my class at 3 a.m. because it's 7 p.m. UK time. But I feel like all of these kind of bleed in together, and just finding that right equilibrium of learning, studying, growing, and giving, I feel like I'm finding a right pace for it. And it's slow, but it's getting better.
Mm. So if there was one thing that our listeners can take away from this conversation that will help them build a better world, what should it be?
I think it's just cultivate a character of stewardship. Because if you're able to give back and you're able to make an impact to one person, then you're making a legacy that outlasts you and you live beyond that. Truism is planting a tree knowing full well that you'll never be able to sit in its shade. And I think that's something that people can take away. But also, I think it's learning to unlearn and embrace your cultural heritage and the lessons that you can get from that.
Unlearning is always a difficult thing to do, right?
It's much harder than learning new things.
Yeah. Okay, so final question. What is one question that an interviewer never asked you that you wish you would get asked?
You've already asked me this, actually, but you asked a little bit about my family. And I think I love to talk about my family so much, because when I have podcasts like this or when I talk about success, I cannot emphasize the importance that my family has given me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're in a very individualistic Western society where we think of individualism and, you know, self-made success. But there are so many lessons I got from my mom and my dad and my uncles and aunts and grandparents that I begrudgingly learned to accept.
Mm-hmm.
So in an individualistic world, we aspire for this kind of selfish, self-made success. But I like to think of myself as an accumulation of these centuries of wisdom that's been passed on and the hard work of those that came before me. So the holistic nature of family and community that made me is what makes me think uniquely and not be afraid to take these risks. And I think that they've given me that ample shelter and safety to think this way, which other families don't usually give their children. I mean, I would never be in farming or agriculture. My parents were like, you know, you need to pursue this Western idea of success. But they were saying, nope, you need to rediscover your culture and who you are. And then that's how you'll become successful.
And I think that's a great place for us to end the conversation. Thank you so much, Louise, for joining us on Crazy Smart Asia. It's been such an interesting and great conversation.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. And it was so lovely to talk with you, Xiaowei.
That's it for yet another episode of Crazy Smart Asia. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. Don't forget to follow us wherever you're listening to this. Crazy Smart Asia is produced by Josie Kota and edited, mixed, and mastered by Ben Beheshti. Genty's digital editor is Valerie Lim. Crazy Smart Asia is hosted by me, Chong Xiao Wei. In the meantime, do remember,
true wisdom is planting a tree knowing full well that you'll never be able to sit in its shade.
See you next week.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.